Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Who is winning the war in Ukraine? Let's get to the bottom line. The Ukraine war is no ordinary territorial dispute between neighbors. As a wise man said recently, this is going to shape the rest of the 21st century. If Russia loses or doesn't get what it wants, it's going to be a different Russia afterward. And if Russia wins, it's going to be a different Europe afterward. The stakes really couldn't be higher. So what's going on in Vladimir Putin's mind right now? Western media paint him as a leader forced into a corner, facing military setbacks and getting more and more frustrated and desperate. How accurate is that? Last week, we got the view from Washington, and today we're getting the view from Moscow. We're talking with Andrei Kortunov, the Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council. He's one of the country's leading experts in Russian foreign policy and international relations. Andrei, it's great to be with you and talking with you right now on such a sober issue. Let me just ask you, from our perceptions in Washington, and one of the things I want to get into today is how what we're seeing in Washington or think we're seeing in Washington may, in fact, not align with how things look for Moscow. But as we've seen a new phase in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine basically develop now, what is the dashboard from your perspective in Moscow?
Well, I think that it would be fair to say that there have been two major developments recently. The first one was, of course, the decision of the president confirmed by the Russian parliament to incorporate the four Ukrainian regions into the Russian Federation. The second one was to launch this partial mobilization, which is an indicator that the special military operation needs some kind of adjustments, that it doesn't bring the results that the Russian leadership was anticipating to get. So I think that these two developments will have at least three major implications for the situation in this conflict. First of all, I think it's now fair to say that any political settlement between Russia and Ukraine is ruled out, at least for the foreseeable future, because you cannot imagine a Ukrainian leadership willing to agree to a major loss of its territory, especially now when Ukraine allegedly has the strategic initiative. It doesn't mean that we will have no negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. There might be negotiations on technical, situational issues. So for instance, some agreements on prisoners exchange. There might be extensions of the grain deal because this grain deal expires in November. It has to be extended further. There might be some consultations on the safety of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, maybe some other agreements. But I don't think that the Ukrainian side is ready or willing to get back to discuss a political settlement with President Putin. And this is what President Zelensky has already stated quite clearly, that he is ready to negotiate with Russia, but not with Putin. So that's the first implication of what has happened. The second implication is that given the fact that Russia has announced this partial mobilization, and the odds are that in a couple of weeks from now, maybe in a month, maybe in 2 months from now, there'll be major reinforcements getting to the front line. It would be logical for Ukraine to try to use the window of opportunity that they still have in order to make as significant advances on the ground as possible. And this is what we already see within a couple of days. Ukrainians were trying to push harder, both in Donbas and in the south. The messages that we get here are mixed. Of course, the Russian military command claims that most of the Ukrainian counteroffensives failed, but this is yet to be seen. But it's clear that we will see, unfortunately, another cycle of escalation, and we don't know how long this cycle of escalation will last for. And finally, I think that definitely Ukraine will try to use these decisions by the Kremlin in order to seek more support from the West. And the Ukrainian leadership has already made a pitch to join NATO. I think this pitch met a mixed reaction in the West, but nevertheless, they expect to get more military assistance, more intelligence support, more support in training of personnel, and more economic support. So, unfortunately, I don't see any light in the end of the tunnel right now. I'm afraid that things are likely to get worse before they can get any better.
How much pain and stress is being felt by Moscow right now over their decisions on Ukraine?
Well, it's also something that has changed dramatically because I think earlier, for most people living in Moscow, it was almost like a computer game in the sense that this conflict was far and far away. Of course, Moscovites felt some pain, but this pain was felt primarily by the Moscow middle class, people who go to, you know, Western boutiques or supermarkets, fast food chains. Definitely, these are primarily young urban professionals. And they felt unhappy, but they are just a minority. They are not the bulk of the Russian society. And those people who live in small towns or in rural areas, in various national republics in the Russian Federation, they didn't feel this pain significantly. Primarily because they do not consume foreign-made goods, they don't go shopping to Western-type malls. And now, of course, it is different because this partial mobilization is something that affects all the regions, and it can affect any family in the country. Not surprisingly, we saw so many people who tried to leave the country. We don't know how many of them, but clearly these are large numbers, maybe hundreds of thousands of people trying to escape this mobilization. Again, I don't think that that constitutes an immediate challenge to the Russian leadership, but definitely this is something that the leadership should keep in mind while planning other actions that might lead to further escalation.
You know, we recently did a show here on The Bottom Line with nuclear experts Corey Shockey from the American Enterprise Institute and John Wolfsthal, who was involved with nuclear and arms control issues in the Obama administration. And they were both rather measured about some of the discussion of a potential use of a tactical nuclear warhead device in this battle. But I'm just sort of interested in not whether President Putin would make that decision or call, but whether or not the consequences of that decision are understood by Russian national security elites and what Rubicon that would mean that you'd be going over.
Well, this is one of the issues which really concern me a lot because I cannot describe what's going on in the Kremlin. I do not know. But I observe that in the public discourse, there is more intention or at least readiness to accept a nuclear war. They say that, well, you know, nuclear war is bad, but if it is controlled, if we're talking about the use of tactical low-yield nuclear weapons, probably this is not the end of the world, and this is something which is affordable. I consider such discussions and such positions to be very dangerous because, of course, once you embark on this road, it is extremely difficult to stop. Even if it is low yield, even if it is just a demonstration use of nuclear weapons somewhere in the Black Sea region or in the Baltic Sea region, but it might lead to an inadvertent escalation, And of course, in the end of the day, it might lead to a strategic nuclear exchange with all the implications that this exchange might bring. So it is dangerous. I think that, of course, it is also clear that all nuclear powers preserve a degree of ambiguity about their nuclear strategies. You do not want to be too explicit about the circumstances under which you might be ready to use nuclear weapons. But I think that it would be in everybody's interest to just exclude the nuclear dimension from this conflict. And I think that any use of nuclear weapons in this conflict will be detrimental to everybody engaged. So that should be avoided. And I think that everybody should reconfirm the statement that was made early this year, I think in January, by the prominent members of the United Nations Security Council, that you cannot win in a nuclear war, and that's why you should not start a nuclear war.
One of the interests that I think a lot of us have in the West that are watching this is to say, how did we get here? Why did Russia invade Ukraine? What was essentially the driver of this moment? Is there a perception that flirting with Ukraine with regards to NATO helped draw Russia into its next Vietnam?
Well, I think that the official narrative here is that it is not really a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's a conflict between Russia and the West. Many officials in this city argue that Ukraine is not an independent actor. Ukraine exists on a life support system provided by the West. And the perception is that Ukraine would have been defeated, would have capitulated long time ago, if not for the Western assistance. So I think the perception here, and this is the narrative which is presented by the Russian leadership, that the West has been anti-Russian for a very long time, that the West would like, if not to completely destroy Russia, then to weaken it to the extent that Russia would cease to be an independent player in international relations. And Ukraine is just a tool in the capable hands of Western politicians. So this is the narrative which is presented by the Russian leadership.
Do you still agree with that, that essentially what we're seeing now are the aftershocks of many decades later of that Soviet empire, that Soviet space still coming undone?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of my paper. Indeed, I made a point, and I still believe that de facto, the Soviet Union did not disintegrate back in 1991, because though the 15 constituent republics declared their independence and started working on their statehoods, but it was a very long and precarious process. And for a long period of time, the former bits and pieces of the Soviet Union stayed together in terms of the economic transportation infrastructure, in terms of logistics, in terms of the perceptions and mentality. Only gradually we saw a real disengagement. And that's why it was so easy to dissolve the Soviet Union. Nobody really cared that much about these decisions, because many people thought that nothing would change, that they would simply, state this independence and life would go on. But gradually we've observed that various countries have developed very different development trajectories. And if you compare, for instance, Russia and Ukraine, you see that these two parts of the former Soviet Union, which constituted the core of the Soviet Union, gradually started diverging from each other. Maybe it was because they inherited different legacies of the Soviet Union, maybe because they got different leaders, but definitely Ukraine was moving in the direction of Western liberal models, not always consistently, with some setbacks. And even now, Ukraine can hardly be qualified as a mature democracy. But Russia started moving away from liberal models, and we've seen a very clear strategic disengagement between Russia and Ukraine, which, of course, contributed a lot to this conflict.
I'm very interested, Andre, in how your friends and colleagues in the international affairs circuit are viewing the solvency of the U.S. relationships inside NATO. You know, you and I have attended some of the same conferences. We see, you know, a kind of celebration, if you will, of NATO again in light of responding after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But at the same time, under their breath, those leaders in Europe will say, we saw January 6th. Things were different under President Trump. We know that America is not as dependable an ally as it once might have been. At least that's their calculation. And I'm interested in whether that is seen as an opportunity in Moscow or a sign of crumbling American influence as compared to ascending American influence.
Well, let me say that within the expert community, at least, nobody questions the fact that we observe an enhanced Western cohesion, that the West has managed to unite itself, partially due to efforts of President Biden, but partially to the decisions made in Europe and also in East Asia. And the main discussion that we have here is about whether this new cohesion is situational, something which was triggered primarily by Russia's actions in Ukraine, and something which is limited to Russia only, something that might end if the conflict is resolved, or if the conflict is frozen, or rather we should look at this cohesion as a strategic shift, something that will go beyond Russia, something which will affect Western attitudes to China, to the Global South, and something that would last for at least a couple of years. Because depending on whether this cohesion is tactical or strategic, we might have very different trajectories of the global order development. And some say that in 2 years from now, maybe in the United States, you will have another Donald Trump, and that will be the end of the Western unity. Others would say that it's not about personalities, but the West is concerned not only about Russia, it is concerned about the rise of China. So this cohesion is there to stay. So this is the discussions that we have in Moscow. Unfortunately, it is more difficult right now to share our views with our colleagues in Europe and the United States, but we're trying to do our best to stay in touch.
I'm interested in whether the change in leadership that a lot of people in the West become obsessed with, that this is all Putin, is it your assessment that that is an accurate analysis, that anyone, not anyone, but that from the available potentials around Russian leadership, that if there were to be someone there, does the system, does the scaffolding around Russian decision-making right now have more to do with Russia's course than one individual?
Though personalities do matter, I don't think that we should limit the problems between Russia and the West to personalities only. I think, unfortunately, they are more serious than just issues of particular leaders.
And let me just ask you finally, Andre, as we often discuss the West and Russia in this situation in a silo, there are other big powers in the world, China, India, others that have basically straddled the relationships. And in particular, I'd be interested in your perception of China's choices right now, and how China could play a role either pro from Russia's perspective, anti, or stay somewhere in between?
I think that China takes a very cautious position in this conflict. Definitely, it would like to support Russia against NATO and against the United States in particular, because it has its own problems with Washington, D.C., and Russia is a natural partner for China in this confrontation. However, I'm not sure that China is ready to support Russia against Ukraine, because China has its own problems of separatism. It doesn't like separatism. It has never recognized the changed legal status of the Crimean Peninsula. It confirms its support of the territorial integrity and independence of Ukraine. So it is not ready to support Moscow against Kyiv. On top of that, we should not forget that China is concerned about secondary sanctions. At least the Chinese private sector is not ready to explicitly violate the EU and the United States restrictions in trade. It is also, you know, country has its own agenda. So I think that China will continue to be very cautious without breaking from Russia. And it will abstain in the United Nations. It will definitely support Russia in terms of buying more Russian oil and gas. But it is not likely to go against Ukraine in an explicit way. But just responding to your question, and that will be my last point, I think that if you put aside this very sad and very tragic conflict with Ukraine, the real challenge that Russia has is not a choice between the West and China. It's a choice between what I would call self-inflicted isolationism and integrationalism. The question is not to choose between the East and the West, between the European Union and East Asia. The question is whether Russia is willing to integrate into a broader international community, or it prefers to stay outside of this community. And this is, I think, a fundamental choice that the country has to make.
Well, that's a very stark and well-articulated fork in the road. Andrei Kortunov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council in Moscow, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for your candor.
Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? War is not just about the battlefield. Perceptions of struggle, of success, loss, ambition, psychological warfare play a huge role. In the West, recent Ukrainian advances have been taken to mean that Russia is losing badly, so Moscow might as well recognize this and give up. But is that really how Moscow sees it? Another problem that's blocking us from piercing through the fog of war is the emphasis on the cult of personality. We're personalizing the issue as if Vladimir Putin is the only problem. Sure, Putin is in control of his country and government, but even if it were someone else, would the next Russian leader have invaded Ukraine much like now, justified by claims that it was vital for Russia's national security? In the West, we tend to mirror image, thinking other nations will think and act like we do. But the truth is that Putin doesn't see the world the same as Joe Biden, and Biden doesn't see the world the same as Zelensky. Regardless of how and when this war ends, it won't be pretty, because war almost never brings about clear-cut solutions to these conflicts of interest. And that's the bottom line.